And I may have too many slides today because I thought with Parker gone, we wouldn't have that many announcements. But here it's almost 20 after. So if we don't finish on time, I'll do my best to try to see what we can get. But turn with me to John chapter 18. And you might just think of a time maybe you stood before a judge. Hopefully it's only been something like a traffic violation, but you know, some of you may have had to stand before a judge with some very serious situations. In this case, of course, we have Jesus standing before Pilate. And I want to try to give you some background today, and I might have to shorten a little bit of it, but give you some history that as I studied it made sense of why did Pilate do what he did. And so you're going to get a little bit of ancient history today. Is everybody ready for history class? I'll try to make it interesting, and we'll see what we can do. But first of all, let's recognize, and we'll set the context, we'll watch a video, that Jesus is now brought before Pilate by the Jewish authorities. John has eliminated the part of Caiaphas. We read about that in the other synoptic gospels. So he moves from Annas to now, of course, Pilate. And we begin to read the dialogue between the two of them. They bring various accusations against Jesus before Caiaphas, but they really don't have a very convincing argument in front of Pilate. And they cannot execute Jesus, but they want Pilate to do so, and he is very unwilling. So let's, if we can, first watch the video to kind of set the scene for what we'll be studying.
Early in the morning, Jesus was taken from Caiaphas' house to the governor's palace. The Jewish authorities did not go inside the palace, for they wanted to keep themselves ritually clean in order to be able to eat the Passover meal. So Pilate went outside to them and asked,
"What do you accuse this man of?"
"We would not have brought him to you if he had not committed a crime."
"Then you yourselves take him and try him according to your own law."
"We are not allowed to put anyone to death."
This happened in order to make come true what Jesus had said when he indicated the kind of death he would die. Pilate went back into the palace and called Jesus.
"Are you the king of the Jews?"
"Does this question come from you? Or have others told you about me?"
"Do you think I'm a Jew? It was your own people and the chief priests who handed you over to me. What have you done?"
"My kingdom does not belong to this world. If my kingdom belonged to this world, my followers would fight to keep me from being handed over to the Jewish authorities. No. My kingdom does not belong here."
"Are you a king then?"
"You say that I am a king. I was born and came into the world for this one purpose, to speak about the truth. Whoever belongs to the truth listens to me."
"And what is truth?"
Pilate went back outside to the people and said to them,
"I cannot find any reason to condemn him, but..." "According to the custom you have, I always set free a prisoner for you during the Passover. Do you want me to set free for you the king of the Jews?"
They answered him with a shout,
"Give us Barabbas! Give us Barabbas!
Barabbas was a bandit. Then Pilate took Jesus and had him whipped. The soldiers made a crown out of thorny branches and put it on his head. Then they put a purple robe on him and came to him and said, "Long live the King of the Jews." And they went up and slapped him. Pilate went back out once more and said to the crowd,
"Look, I will bring him out here to you to let you see that I cannot find any reason to condemn him. Look, here is the man."
So Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe.
"Crucify him!
Crucify him!"
"Take him then and crucify him. I find no reason to condemn him."
"We have a law that says he ought to die because he claimed to be the Son of God."
When Pilate heard this, he was even more afraid.
Okay, that gives us enough there to kind of begin with. Turn with me, if you would, to John chapter 18. We'll start in verse 28. We're going to look at a couple of things. First of all, of course, Jesus being brought before Pilate. What we see here is in the early morning, they bring Jesus to Pilate. And I found this week, that actually in that particular time period, the courts actually ran from sunrise to sunset. So even though it was early morning, they were already in session, a little different than the court system we have today. And they lead Jesus into what's called the Hall of Judgment, or the Praetorium. That was where the Roman garrison was actually built, Fort Antonius, right up against the temple. And of course, we also see them going into the temple at this point. And in this particular situation, then, he's already been charged with blasphemy. If you want to put some notes into your handout there, you might put down Mark 14, because that kind of fills in the space between what we studied last time and what we study here. But it's interesting now, when the Jewish leaders come before Pilate, they don't make those charges. You know, instead, it's this famous line, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." They recognize that they have a pretty weak case, if you think about it here. So they just simply say, "We wouldn't bring him to you if he wasn't guilty. So he's guilty, so just execute him. That's all we're looking for you to do." But they did not enter into that, and I think the video shows it accurately, because just before the Passover, they did not want to enter into a place where defilement had taken place. What is that defilement? Well, today, Pastor Graham quoted from John MacArthur. I'll quote from John MacArthur. I had never heard this before. That in that particular place, if there was ever an abortion or a dead body, the Romans would take them out and recognize that if you touched a dead body, you were ceremonially unclean. So it is interesting that that's the reason they don't enter in, not just because it's a Gentile place. Apparently they had come into it before, but they did not want to do anything that would prevent them from participating in the Passover. If you want to talk about the various charges, we don't see many here in the Gospel of John. And I might just mention that we normally place our PDF of this. So if later on you would like to look at this in more detail, Parker did not have a chance to put it up today. At least last time I checked a few minutes ago, he hadn't. But it will be up there, I'm sure. You can see that a lot of those charges are not listed in the Gospel of John, but we find a lot of them in Luke 23. But first of all, in Matthew 26, we see that they charged him with threatening to destroy the temple. Now, when he's talking about the temple, he's talking about his body. They claimed, we already saw, that he was an evildoer. And then we see in Luke 23 most of the charges that were brought, that he perverts the nation, that he had forbidden Jews to pay taxes, which was not true, of course, that he was a revolutionary agitator, and that he makes himself king. Now, that's implied here because you see the interaction between Pilate and Jesus about his claim or lack thereof of being a king, and then finally claim to be the Son of God, which we're going to see in just a minute. And so you can see that you can come up with about 7 different charges pulling the Gospels together to see those were charges that were brought. But when they come before Pilate, they're kind of mute. He just said, well, he's guilty. You don't need to know all the details. He's just guilty. And that's where we find ourselves at this particular point. Interestingly enough, Pilate pretty much lets them, in a sense, do what they want. And he really is sort of asking the question, if you think about it, all the way through this interchange. I think the video showed it pretty well. Why am I involved in this? This is a religious matter. You're Jewish leaders. You take care of it yourself. And he's really kind of unclear as to why they brought Jesus to him. And the reason is they could not execute him. And here you see again a fulfillment of prophecy. Because it was not... No, I'm going to dip into Roman history. It wasn't until A.D. 30 that Israel lost the right of execution. If this had happened, say, even a few years before, Jesus could simply be executed by the Jewish leaders. And how would he be executed? By stoning. But, of course, we see in Psalm 22 in the Messianic prophecy that he would be lifted up, that he would be pierced, that they would not break his bones. You go to Psalm 22, which is a messianic psalm. It tells you all the things that will happen to the Messiah. And interesting enough, Psalm 22 was written almost 1,000 years before crucifixion had ever been instituted. It was instituted by other barbarians, and the Romans adopted it. But up until A.D. 30, if indeed the Jewish leaders saw anybody who was guilty, they would kill them by stoning. It was death by stoning, but now that has been taken away from them. I'll explain a little bit more about Roman history in just a minute. And so now you see how that is a fulfillment of Psalm 22. There's also a cultural aspect. There's a legal aspect. They cannot kill anyone. But number two, there's a cultural aspect of it as well, because it was not lawful for them, but it was also not possible for them to actually use execution. Because execution on a cross was the same, at least in the Old Testament Torah, in the Old Testament law code, as hanging. And the Mosaic principle is this. You see this in Deuteronomy 21, where it says, anyone who is hung on a tree is under God's curse. And if you notice, for those of you taking notes, you might put down Galatians 3:13, because here, as Paul is writing about Jesus, he said, cursed is he who hangs on a tree. So you can see that both in the Old Testament as the law code and then as the fulfillment you see in the New Testament in Galatians 3, this is a fulfillment of prophecy because Jesus was crucified and that could only be done by the Romans. Hence this constant interchange between the Romans and the Jewish authorities because Pilate really doesn't want to put him to death. I think the video shows it very accurately. You know, this is your issue. You take care of it. He even in one point says, you crucify him. Of course, he knows they can't crucify him. They would be crucified if they crucified him, basically. But he's just being flippant. He doesn't want this. This is not something that he wanted to do. And we see that they are constantly pushing him to do so because they, first of all, lack the legal authority to do so. And second of all, culturally, they could not do that as well. Okay, well, at this point, you're going to say, okay, I'm going to let you kind of in on a little bit of the history of Pilate. Why is he so resistant to this? I mean, most of the caricatures you see of Pilate or even of Roman generals is they don't care. They're willing to kill somebody for a moment's notice and execute anything that is going to threaten the Pax Romana. Why do we see Pilate vacillating so much? Well, it turns out that Pilate obviously had control of the province, but the reality is that most of his troops are in Caesarea. I'm going to show you a picture in just a minute, but if any of you have ever been on a tour, Gary Fraser just walked in to say hi to me a minute ago, or with Jack Graham, or I've been on one, we're going to do another one, you know, you recognize that this is pretty far away from Jerusalem. It's on the Mediterranean coast. That's where the troops are. This is a place that is built, and it looks a lot like Rome. Now, during various times where there could be tension, Passover being one of those, they would bring individuals down to Jerusalem. But most of the troops, the whole cohorts, there were 3 or 4 cohorts in Caesarea, are not there. So first of all, he doesn't have as many troops as he would like to have. If indeed there was any kind of Jewish rebellion, they are really outnumbered. So the first issue you've got to understand is that he does have the power of life and death. He could even reverse capital sentences by the Sanhedrin, which he looks like he's trying to do in this case. But we learn a little bit more. There are these incredible tensions going on at this point. We read about this from the Jewish historian Josephus. And the tensions between Pilate and the Jews are huge. First, you'll have the issue of the Roman images that he placed, money that he stole from the temple to build an aqueduct. And later, because of so much tension, by AD 35, he is ordered by Tiberius to go back to Rome. Turns out that as he is traveling back to Rome, Tiberius dies, and we sort of lose track of Pilate. Some think he was killed, others think he committed suicide, others think he just escaped. Nobody really knows. We lose track of him. So he's really in this window between about 30 AD, when he is able to execute prisoners, and 35. So you can kind of get a pretty good idea of where Jesus is. But if you want to understand his dilemma, I put the circle down below there, and that's the circle of course, Jerusalem. And Caesarea is way up there. So the troops are up there. He's brought in maybe a cohort, maybe a legion, probably not. Probably just a very small band to keep peace in that region. And that's really all that he has. And so he is really not looking for anything that's going to threaten his particular position. To understand a little bit more of this, let me go into Jewish history for just a minute. This may be more history than you want, but maybe this will be the only time you'll get a chance to hear it. And that is, after Herod the Great died, they actually divided all the jurisdiction that he had over his three sons. You have Antipas, and we actually read about Herod Antipas in the Bible. Then you have Archelaus, and then you have Philip. Archelaus was the one that actually governed Samaria and Judea, this region right here. But the problem was he was a tyrant, and he was an extortioner, and the people hated him, and so much so that the Jews actually appealed to Rome, and they got rid of him. And so in order to deal with that power vacuum, Rome, under mostly Tiberius, began to send pure curators there, and the one pure curator by the name of Pilate actually arrived on the scene in AD 26. By the way, if you go to Caesarea, one of the trips that Prestonwood provides, they actually have a mock-up of some stones that actually have Pilate's name on them in Caesarea. This gives you archaeological verification for what we're reading right here, interestingly enough. And of course, he lasts, as I said, till AD 35. His problems were immense. The first is that when he comes to power and he comes from Caesarea into Jerusalem, he realizes as he looks around, there are no Roman standards. And so he begins to put up Roman standards, begins to put up Roman images. Well, the Jews just have a fit about this because indeed, this would then be false idols. And so they began to hound Pilate day after day after day. He finally leaves Jerusalem, goes back to Caesarea, and the people all go to Caesarea now to again and complain about all these Roman images up there. And Pilate at one point has it. He's finally had enough. So he gathers all the people in the amphitheater. And if you ever travel to Caesarea, you can actually sit right where they were sitting. And then, in a surprise, he brings in all the guards and says, "You will stop threatening me about these Roman images or we will kill you." And so you have these Roman soldiers with their swords out. And what do the Jews do? They bare their necks and say, "Go ahead and kill us." Well, at this point, then he backs down, and all of a sudden now the Jews recognize they really have Pilate over a barrel, don't they? And so then the next major problem that they have is that he now takes money from the temple treasury and uses that to build another aqueduct into Jerusalem. And this creates another controversy. This all precedes Jesus, by the way. And if you've ever seen a movie on Jesus, sometimes they will show this scene preceding before Jesus is there, because now you have a riot in the streets, and the people are rioting and everything. Well, what Pilate did in this case is he had his soldiers go in under plain clothes. When the rioters come out, they throw off their plain clothes, and they now begin to stab and kill all of the rioters. So now this is a pretty tense situation, and if that's not enough, let me add a third one. And that is, he actually was in Herod's palace. We saw a picture of that there. And in Herod's palace, this happens a few years before Jesus is there as well, he was beginning to hang Roman shields in this palace. Think about this, right next to the temple. And then he has a picture of Emperor Tiberius. And at this point, the Jews protest so much that they again protest to Rome, and Tiberius orders Pilate to take down the shields and take down the pictures. So at this point, we meet Pilate now, and he definitely has his tail between his legs. Do you get the sense of why now Pilate is vacillating in ways that you would never have expected before? So let's move on here. Now we come to the part about entering the headquarters, calls Jesus to him, and he asks some very fundamental questions. And he says, "Are you king of the Jews?" And Jesus really does not affirm or deny the question. And this point you can begin to see in verse 35 here. Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and chief priests have delivered you over to me. What have you done?" And we just saw that in the video. But in this case, you can see that Pilate is just getting very frustrated. They're forcing me once again to do something I don't want to do. And so he feels like this is nothing more than sort of petty religious bickering. But at the same time, he recognizes that in some cases, the Jews have been able to appeal to Tiberius or to others to get him to do things he really did not want to do. And so, of course, we see in verse 36 where he proclaims that his kingdom is not of this world, and even makes the point, which I think would appeal to Pilate, you know, really, if I had a kingdom of this world, don't you think my followers would have prevented me from being handed over to the Jews? And I think John points that out to show that, again, he's still in control even at this 11th hour. And then he says that I was born for this purpose, came into the world. His purpose was to bear witness to the truth, and concludes that everyone who listens to the truth is one who listens to his voice. And that brings us to the famous line by Pilate, which is what? What is truth? We have time at the end here. I'll go into that in a little more detail. But then proclaims, as we just saw, I find no guilt in him, but in a willingness to appease the Jews, says you can select a prisoner of choice for the Passover. And so they choose who? Barabbas. Now you might not have noticed, but if you look in the Greek, there is a play on words, because Barabbas is really Bar Abbas, which is basically the son of the father. So Barabbas' name is son of the father. And so there's a play on words that John is using here, and that is, the son of a father was released while the son of the father actually was sentenced to death. Just a play of words that you pick up if you get into the Greek a little bit. And I thought it was kind of interesting, because if you've never heard this story, I found this week, and it was one of these illustrations, too good to pass up, about a Scottish farmer. This is a true story, whose name was Fleming, and he was working in a bog. And he heard this child screaming, and he goes to this one part of the bog and finds that this child is up to about his waist in the mud and muck. And so he's able to go in there and save the child. The next day, at his farm, this fancy carriage pulls up and this nobleman steps out and says, "You saved the life of my son. I would like to pay you for what you've done. I would like to repay you for your good deed." And he says, "No, I don't need you to pay me." And about that time, the farmer's son runs out and he says, "Well, if you would not allow me to pay you, could I at least then pay for your son to go to college, to go and get an education?" Well, the son goes to St. Mary's Medical School, and he is Sir Alexander Fleming, the man who discovered penicillin. The story does not end there, though, interesting enough, because that same son that was stuck in a bog later on when he's an adult, he's stricken with pneumonia, and so the doctors treat that son of Randolph Churchill with penicillin. That son is Winston Churchill. And that's the connection between Winston Churchill and Alexander Fleming. But again, we're talking about the son of a father actually going free, while the son of the father actually going to his death. And you think about the witnesses to all of this. You have Malchus, who has his ear cut off and then restored, and he's sort of an innocent bystander. You have, of course, Peter, who denies Jesus while by the soldier's fire. You have Annas illegally putting Jesus on trial. And then finally you have Pilate, who's confused and just wants to get rid of him. This would be a great sermon message to say, look at these four witnesses. But it illustrates that even though you have four witnesses with four different decisions, there's really no place to hide when you're talking about Jesus, whether you're standing by the fire, whether you're just simply helping someone capture him, whether you're actually the judge, or whether indeed you are the one that is the Roman judge or the Jewish judge, I think it's an illustration that all of us have to give an account before Jesus. So finally, let's go now to chapter 19, and that is that Jesus is now to be crucified. And we see how that plays itself out. If you've read any of the commentaries on this, it's amazing how many books have been written over the years by jurists, many of whom became Christians. Frank Morrison is a good example, and others who, as they read that about the trial, first of all talked about how there were so many illegalities and so many laws that were broken during these proceedings. But nevertheless, in the midst of that, lots of people have become Christians. But through it all, we see that even with all these laws that were broken, God worked to provide an ultimate sacrifice for our sins. And here we see Pilate is being pressured by the crowd. He finally gives into the threat and indeed recognizes that if he does not, then he's going to face something because he has claimed to not be a friend of Caesar. Now, there is a pretty good argument that could be made that as we see this first part of this, Pilate really did not intend for Jesus to be crucified. If you go and put all four Gospels together, the three Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John, and work out a timeline, you come up with a reality that there may have been two floggings. If you accept that, then many people have suggested that that first flogging might have been a fustigatio, which is actually kind of the least severe flogging, where he was beaten a number of times, but nothing like you saw on the Passion of the Christ. And that then they put the robe on him, put the crown on him with the idea, see, we've done enough. Because I think the video sort of even implied that, because at one point he says, what, behold the man. Kind of like, okay, I've punished him. That's enough. But that's not enough, of course, for those. That means that if indeed that's the case, there was a second flogging, verberatio, which is one that was so severe as to really try to hasten death. And so some argue that if indeed there were the two floggings, that second one was just like what you saw. Remember Passion of the Christ? Wasn't that gruesome? As I've said before, there were two professors I know at Dallas Theological Seminary who were watching this, and the one professor turned to the other and said, do you think it was that bad? And the other professor said, in light of what I've read, it was probably even worse than what we're seeing on the screen. And the goal there was to just almost bring you to the point of death so that when you're up on the cross, you wouldn't live very long because the goal was to kill off everybody before the Passover. And so if indeed that is the case, there may have been two floggings. I think there were probably three trials of Jesus and two floggings, now based if you put all of the Gospels together. And so you recognize what, again, our Lord went through on that particular day. But again, after that, humiliation of the prisoner, that was required by Roman law to then show them, and that's where he says, behold the man, esse homo, which is the Latin. And this should have been enough, so Pilate thought, for them to say, okay, you've punished him. But instead, the crowd now says, take him, crucify him. And John says, crucify him because he made himself the Son of God, which is again one of those seven challenges at this point. Now, finding no success, we see this in verses 8 through 11. Look at verse 8, for example, here. When Pilate heard this statement, he was even more afraid. He entered the headquarters again and said to Jesus, who are you from? But Jesus gave him no answer. And why is he in fear? Well, it turns out that the mob could break that sacred Pax Romana. His troops are in Caesarea. He's got a contingent here. But what is now going to happen? And if indeed a riot breaks out, his position as procreator is in jeopardy. But really his life is in jeopardy. And notice what Jesus says at this point. You know, you have power only because it was given to you from above. If you want to put down some notes, maybe put down in your notes there Romans 13 verse 1, where it talks about all government and it is what? It's created by God. And that we have those who have authority over us ultimately under the rule of God himself. And so at this point now we learn that the governor had some sense of justice, but what he finds is that this screaming mob is forcing him to do something he really does not want to do. And they actually raise this very important question at this point, and that is verse 12. From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar." And this friend of Caesar, or Caesar's friend, had a meaning in that first century. And that it was the idea that you were part of the inner circle. You were a friend of Caesar's, and thus you have rule, power, and authority. And they were, in a sense, by saying you're no friend of Caesar's, threatening that the high priest would then contact Rome, most likely Tiberius, and that would then put him in jeopardy because he refused to bring someone to justice. Again, let me slip into what we know about the Emperor Tiberius at this time from Roman history. We know this from Tacitus and Suetonius and others, that he was notoriously bitter and suspicious of rivals. So it's most likely that Tiberius would end the career and the life of Pilate. So this threat about you are no longer a friend of Caesar's was a threat to say, if you do not do what we do, we will make sure that you die at the hands of Tiberius. So at this point, you can see what he finally does. And John gives us all the details of where this takes place, the stone pavement, the Aramaic Gabbatha, and all the rest. And so we have the historical basis of that. So now, of course, he basically caves into the wishes of those. And so first he says, "Behold the man." Now what does he say? "Behold your king." Which leads the people instead saying, "We have no king but Caesar." Whereas if you could have a footnote here, it would have been, "which he did not believe," you know, which he did not take. But again, it then finally says that he delivered him over to them. And some people have misunderstood that "them" there refers to the Roman soldiers. And when we get together next time, we'll have a chance to see the crucifixion. So that's a little bit of the backstory of history. Got just a few minutes, so I probably won't be able to go into this as much detail as we'd like. But here, I think Pilate raises a very good question, and I like to always give us some application, as Brad talks about. And one of the applications is this whole issue of truth, because if you think about it, Pilate asks the universal question, what is truth? And here, if you're taking some notes, you might put down, you know, in John 18, verse 37, that Jesus came to bear witness of the truth. And Pilate asked this question about truth. And I would suggest to you today that we have a lot of people kind of like Pilate, don't we? That we are in the midst of. People that say, well, truth is relative, or truth is personal, or truth is whatever you believe it is. Barna Research recently did some surveys of people asking if they believed in absolute truth, and found that 66% of adults responded that they believe that, quote, there is no such thing as absolute truth. Different people can define truth in conflicting ways and still be correct. 2/3 of the people agreed with that statement. Well, that percentage was even higher when you got to young adults. It was 72% of those age 18 to 25. And I've noticed in watching some of these surveys that that seems to be increasing every single year. So we have to recognize that, if anything, we live in this world where indeed there is a tremendous amount of truth that is being portrayed, but it's important for us to recognize how to respond to it. Real quickly, and I'll leave this up there because we're getting close on time, but there are at least two different kinds of relative truth that we see today. One is what you might call cultural relativism. This is the belief that all ethical truth and all truth is relative to a specific culture. In other words, this particular culture has their view of truth, another culture has its view of truth, a third view might have a third view of truth. And so there's no ultimate standard of right and wrong in which to judge a culture. And that's what you get today if you take a class in cultural anthropology. It's one of the reasons why cultural anthropologists are so critical of missionaries, because you're taking your view of truth into another culture. And so you are actually interrupting what they should do. And so as a result, they have this idea that what may be right in one culture might be wrong in another. But who are we to say that this particular practice is wrong? The problem with that is, there's lots of problems, but just in the interest of time, I'll give you a few. First of all, you cannot condemn any action. Just think about that. If indeed you took it to its logical extension, you could not have had the Nuremberg trials for the Nazi generals. You could not have the Hague today for cultural and ethnic cleansing. Could not have any of that. Because you'd say, well, you know, that was just the Nazi view of ethics, or that was just the view of the Yugoslavian provinces, Croatia and Serbia and Herzegovina's view of ethics or something like that. Second of all, you would have no sense of moral standards because they could change over time. There was a time in which polygamy was allowed in Utah, but then in order for Utah to become a state, they said, you have to change your laws. So they did, and so technically polygamy is outlawed in Utah. Now with same-sex marriage becoming legal, they're using that as an argument to argue back to polygamy. So you've been, it was legal, it was not legal, it may become legal again. You can see how that changes. Of course, there's no explanation for right and wrong and origin of morals and all that. And most importantly, you can't reconcile cultures. You might say, well, I may not like what Muslim cultures do. I certainly don't like what Muslim cultures do to women. But that's their culture. You know, we treat women differently in the West. You see the problem with that? And so cultural relativism is something that's been promoted, but it doesn't work very well. Well, that's kind of the big picture. What about the small picture? Well, first of all, we'll look at this one. You know, one of the arguments that used to be used in cultural relativism was the idea that, well, if this is what they do in India, that's just their cultural phenomenon. And one of those is the idea of suti, which was to actually, when a man would die, to also burn the wife to death. And I love how General Napier, when he was in India, responded. He said, well, you say that that is your custom to burn widows. Very well. We also have a custom. When men burn a woman alive, we tie a rope around their necks and we hang them. Build your funeral pyre beside it, and my carpenters will build a gallows. You follow your custom, and then we will follow ours. See the problem? You know, you can't use that cultural relativism too easily, can you? Let's go to the other one real quickly. And that is another form of relativism that you run into all the time is utilitarianism. If you were listening to my radio program this week, we got talking about that a little bit. It's a big word for basically saying that we have to figure out the greatest good for the greatest number. A lot of people just simply say, you know, if there is no God or there are no absolutes, there's no moral standard, I can't trust the Bible, well, then I'll just assume that I'll do what is the greatest good for the greatest number. Except the problem with that one simply is that it creates kind of an end justifies the means mentality. Whatever the end is, justifies the means by which we get there. That sounds pretty dangerous. Number two, it can't protect the minorities. If you're a minority, you do not want a greatest good for the greatest number because you're not the greatest good. You're not the greatest number and you might actually lose out. And most importantly, it's kind of hard to predict the consequences. You might do what you think is best for people, and it doesn't turn out so well. We're on the 50th anniversary of things like the War on Poverty, the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, 50th anniversary now of the Voting Rights Act. Some turned out so well, some didn't turn out so well, because people can't really predict the consequences. And of course, there's no objective foundation to make judgments. It kind of turns the Ten Commandments into this: thou shalt not cheat unless the alternative is failure. Thou shalt not steal unless it's just music downloads for personal use. Thou shalt not use pornography unless everybody else is doing it. Thou shalt not gamble unless it happens to be your lucky day. Thou shalt not lie, because how could that hurt anyone? You know, it kind of turns the Ten Commandments into thou shalt not usually or sometimes. It just depends. I'll figure out what situation. And of course, that leads us to the conclusion that we'll talk about for just a minute. That is, how do we think about biblical truth from a biblical point of view? And in my book, Christian Ethics in Plain Language, we talk about the fact that, first of all, a biblical view of truth is based upon God's revelation, that God has revealed himself in nature and in our conscience and in the Bible and in the person of Jesus Christ. And let's just think about some of the verses we've looked at just in the last couple of weeks in John that remind us of biblical truth. The first one I put up there, of course, is from Deuteronomy, that God is a God of truth. And so we recognize that truth is something that we should support. You know, when Pilate says, what is truth? Well, the answer to that is God is truth. You know, God's character is truth. That God's character is the standard by which we determine what is right and wrong. But let's look at a couple of verses that we've already looked at in these last few weeks in the Gospel of John. Because first of all, Jesus is truth. He said, I am the way, the truth, and life. No one comes to the Father but through me. Do you want to know what truth is? Well, God is truth. Jesus is truth. Jesus later on is described as being full of truth. And then later we see also that the Bible is true. You know, so we can say that God is true, Jesus is true, the Bible is true. That should be enough, but then the Apostle Paul tells us not only to believe it, but apply it. And here's just two verses real quickly. For example, in Ephesians 4, there's a whole section there where Paul is telling us as believers, as Christians, that we should walk in the truth. And then he also, as he is leaving perhaps the last letter he ever wrote to Timothy, he tells Timothy that Christians should teach others the truth. We should entrust in faithful men who will teach others also. And so truth is not something we believe, it's also something we apply in our daily walk, and it's something we teach to others. So that's kind of a view of biblical truth, real quickly. We can see that certainly when we look at the Old Testament, it gives us an idea of social ethics, how government should be put together, although a lot of that applies only to the Old Testament. It's the foundation there. But also even in the Old Testament, we have a lot of the Proverbs that apply to our own personal ethics. And then in the New Testament, we have personal ethics that apply to morality within the church. But most importantly, we recognize that even though we have an Old Testament and a New Testament, there may be a discontinuity between the Old Testament and New Testament when it comes to ceremonial law or civil law, but there's continuity in terms of moral law. And that's helpful because sometimes if you say, well, I think that homosexuality is wrong, well, they'll say, well, yeah, that's in the Old Testament, but, you know, in that same part where it says that homosexuality is detestable, it also said that you're not supposed to eat shellfish. And I've seen you at Red Lobster's or Joe's Crab Shack, so, you know, obviously you don't hold to that. And it says you're not supposed to wear clothing that are mixed threads, and I can see some of you are wearing that. So obviously you really don't believe in applying these Old Testament laws. And I would say when it comes to a ceremonial law, I haven't seen any animal sacrifices lately here at Prestonwood. Matter of fact, I did not know until today that cats will not be in heaven. That was a new one to me. Okay, I did not know that. That was new to me. But nevertheless, you know, we don't have animal sacrifices. We don't have a high priest. So we recognize those are gone. There's a discontinuity there. But we recognize the moral law continues on. You know, is sex outside of marriage wrong in the Old Testament? Sex outside of marriage wrong in the New Testament? Is murder wrong in the Old Testament? Murder wrong in the New Testament? See the point? And so we can answer those questions, but recognize how important it is. Well, we don't have a lot of time, so I'll close with some of this, but simply to say that if you're interested in this idea of what is truth and how do you think biblically about those issues, I might recommend two books. One, a good friend of ours, Frank Beckwith, and Greg Kokel. Greg Kokel's with Stand to Reason. Relativism, feet firmly planted in midair. I love that, you know. And if you want to understand some of the people you're dealing with and their belief in relativism and relative ethics and utilitarianism, cultural relativism or postmodernism, it is an outstanding book. And there's also an audio book that goes with it, DVDs and all sorts of things. So that's one. And of course, my book, Christian Ethics in Plain Language, just some resources that might be helpful. And just as we close, let me encourage those of you that are men only, sorry, on this one. We've got the men's retreat this weekend, and it's going to be a great opportunity. And last year, we had Skip Heisek and Tony Evans, and it was just a great lineup. But look at the lineup this time. I mean, this is going to be really something. So lots of fun. Let me mention also, just before I sit down, that last week I made available some CDs from the interview I did with Bruce Ivey, the one that did the Dropbox. I think most of you got one, but if you didn't, I have some of those. And then this week, some that we did with J.J. Jasper, about the losing of his son, losing Cooper. So I'll keep those up here in case anybody wants some CDs, and I'll turn it back over to Brad.